Greetings, Internet. I'm Todd Colkin, a solo practitioner here in the great city of New York, and this is Ethics Compliance for Solo Practitioners. So today we're going to go through what is probably the most important yet most, I would say, underrated topic in CLE, which is the rules of professional responsibility. It is something that we need to deal with on a literal daily basis, even though we don't exactly get the bill for thinking about or talking about or dealing with the ethics compliance in general. But, you know, that's okay. Just because we can't bill for it actively with our clients doesn't mean it's not important, doesn't mean that we are exempt from dealing with it. So what we're going to go through today is a bunch of the rules of professional responsibility, the sort of the big ones, the ones that affect our lives on a daily basis. And we're going to talk specifically about how to keep in compliance with those as a solo practitioner. So for those of you folks who run your own practice, or maybe you're part of a small firm that doesn't have an ethics department or ethics counsel, or a fancy schmancy automatic conflict check system, this is for you. So that said, let's get started. So what's on our agenda today? We're going to go through all of what I consider the major rules of professional responsibility. So we're going to start with the all-important confidentiality, move on to conflict of interest. We're going to talk about solicitation. I'm also going to talk with you about networking as it relates to solicitation, because if you're a solo practitioner like me, you're responsible for bringing in the clients. And if you're not networking, you're not bringing in the clients. So now, just because you're networking and you're out and you're not in a courtroom or in a boardroom, it does not mean that the rules of professional responsibility do not apply to those interactions. So we're going to discuss those in detail. We're also going to go into the no contact rule, which is super important for both you litigators out there and for you business attorneys out there, because it applies to both types of scenarios. We're going to talk about referral fees, which is extremely important for solos like me, especially those who often farm out different matters to different types of attorneys, and you know who you are. We're going to talk about communicating with unrepresented persons, which is effectively the no contact rule, except when there's no other attorney involved. We're going to talk about attorney as third party neutral. This is something that I deal with not super often, but often enough to merit some time here in this presentation. And as a solo practitioner, you may also have to deal with being attorney as third party neutral. We're going to talk about trust account issues. Yes, the all important trust account. It is for solo practitioners particularly, it can be treacherous because there's nobody looking over your shoulder, as opposed to if you're at a medium or large sized firm where there is an entire department and protocol constantly looking over your shoulder. And unless you're the managing partner, you probably don't even have access to the trust account directly. So for us solo practitioners, we are just one degree of separation away from it, and it's really important that we go through it. Now, I'm not going to bore you with and try to scare you for its own sake. I've seen that happen in other CLEs, and also you probably remember during law school, all of those times, they try to scare you. But that's not productive. I think what's productive is to give you some practical tips and tricks as to how to keep yourself compliant and to deal and how to sort of intuit how to deal with the trust account, because some of the things are not entirely intuitive. So we'll get into that in detail. We're also going to talk about non-law practice activities. This is really important for those of you who, like me, if you're a solo practitioner, you're an entrepreneur, and your legal mind is applicable to all different types of stuff, which is one of the things I absolutely love about the laws, is because it is the thing that connects, rather the thing that affects in society pretty much every aspect of life. And so you're an attorney and you're entrepreneurial and you're a solo practitioner, the day will come, or if it hasn't already, where someone will say, hey, I would like to be able to use your brain in a different way other than the traditional Legal practice. So that's considered, a non-law practice activity. If you're a solo practitioner and you're interested in that kind of thing, having an additional revenue stream, it's pretty cool. And we'll discuss that in detail. Next, we'll talk about duties to prospective clients. This is something that is a little, it's a little shaky for some. I know the classic example that everyone goes through is, oh, if you have, a divorce and one party is just going to every divorce lawyer in town and doing initial consults just to keep the other side from having an attorney. You know, that's not entirely the only situation where the duties to prospective clients comes up. And so I think it's really important that for solo practitioners that we really get into it, really get into the weeds, fully understand exactly what the duties of prospective clients are so that you can act accordingly. And finally, in terms of Q&A, understanding this is being pre-recorded here, my contact information is on the first and last slide. And so if you have any questions about any of this stuff or about anything else, you can give me a call or even better, shoot me an email. That said, let's get going with confidentiality. Now, I'm going to go through the model rules of professional responsibility just in general because that's applicable to almost every state. Occasionally, I might veer off into New York, into the New York rules of professional responsibility. They technically adopted the ABA model rules back in 2000 and I believe it was 2001 or 2002, but they kind of put their own spin on it. So we'll discuss a couple of those differences. But for the most part, we're going to be talking about the model rules. That way, attorneys in every state can benefit. So model rule 1.6, we'll start by reading the chapter and verse, and then we'll go into some actual detail. End quote. A lawyer shall not reveal information relating to the representation of a client unless the client gives informed consent. The disclosure is impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation or the disclosure is permitted. Okay. And this also applies to the initial consult, regardless of whether you actually take on the representation thereafter. That's rule 1.18. That's the that has to do with duties of prospective clients. We'll go into that in more detail. But let's go into the meat and potatoes of confidentiality. So there are a couple of things to consider here. First and foremost, the question of what is considered confidential. Now, a lot of folks like to say, well, everything's confidential. And that's not exactly how it works. Confidentiality under the rules, and it reflects how attorney-client privilege is treated in litigation. So you litigators out there are going to probably appreciate this. Is if you have a communication between an attorney and their client directly, and there's no third party involved, and the client has made it clear that whatever information that you're receiving during that communication is considered is a secret or something that you don't want a third party to hear. That is, sort of classic attorney-client privilege confidentiality. Now, there is a little spin on this that is worth considering, and that's what happens if you have a third party on the phone. Now, this happens all the time. I'll have a client on the phone for something related to a transaction, let's say, and we have a third party, a consultant or something like that on the phone. Now, technically speaking, if this were considered the question of in litigation, is there attorney-client privilege for this communication, it's arguable that because a third party is involved, it's not subject to attorney-client privilege. And that may be true if you're trying to either keep something in evidence or take it out of evidence. But for the purposes of Model Rule 1.6, confidentiality still applies. So when we do this in practice, and especially when you have a third party on the phone, here's how I like to do it. And, obviously you can take this advice or not. But what I like to do is whenever I'm in a situation where a third party is here, involved, and it is important to bring up something that is considered confidential, like a trade secret or how a business model works or anything like that, I always say in front of the third party, and I always give the client a heads up prior. I say, look, in order to have this conversation, I need to be able to reveal certain things that I believe are confidential. Is it okay for me to do that? And keep in, and I always tell the client, keep in mind that by disclosing this to this third party, you have, it's not, this communication itself is not attorney-client privilege. And that's part of the informed consent part, right? You need to tell the client before you reveal the information what's implied in the revealing of that information to a third party. If you're not doing that, and you're not giving informed consent, and you're not being in compliance with the rules. And look, that's super easy, in terms of just telling the client, look, this is, you run the risk that this information gets out. Or if you're a litigator, you say, look, we run the risk that someone might try to bring this into evidence or something along those lines. So they can, you can ask, and you, your client can ask you questions about it. You can give them an honest answer about, whether it, how likely it is, what the risk calculus is, how to do it. But at the end of the day, so long as you've made your client aware of what the risks are associated with it, and they say yes, that's okay, then you've obtained informed consent. Is it best to get that in writing? Absolutely. Is that always possible? No, it's not always going to be the case. You do what you can. Now, in terms of the disclosure being impliedly authorized, so obviously you have to be able to make that disclosure, to a judge in a sidebar or something along those lines. So it, or you have to be able to put the relevant facts in a pleading or in a motion or something along those lines. So, that stuff is relatively obvious. By contrast, it's not obvious on the business side when the disclosure is impliedly authorized, but when it comes to making those disclosures to, say, an accountant, if you have to explain to your client's accountant, how their business model works, again, so long as you get the informed consent. But even if you don't, what I like to do is when on the business side, if I'm dealing with a client's, consultant or someone else that they're working with in general, I have them sign a non-disclosure agreement, and then let them know that this is the kind of thing that is subject to confidentiality. They usually agree to it, and that's fine. Now, one more time, it applies to the initial consult regardless of whether you end up representing the client, and the question of whether that information that you received in the initial consult makes it impossible for you to represent their potential adversary down the line. That's a question of duties to prospective clients, but it also is inherent to conflict of interest, which is where we're going to go to right now. Conflict of interest in New York and also with the model rules, we're dealing with 1.7 through 1.10. Let's start with the definition. That's really important. So, what is a conflict of interest? It's where, number one, representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client. This is rather simple. If, say, for example, you're in litigation, you can't represent both sides of the litigation. One can only serve one master. Or rather, should I say, one can only serve one team in litigation. So, or two, there is a significant risk. Here are those, modifiers that make things so confusing, that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, or a third person, or by personal interest of the lawyer. So let's break this down. So significant risk, that means more than nominal, right? So if we were to break it down into percentages, you know how when you're telling the jury that preponderance of the evidence just means that you're 51% certain as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt, which means you have to be 95% sure. Here, a significant risk, I would go with if you are more than 10% sure, rather should I say, if you think there's more of a 10% risk that representation of one client will be limited by your responsibilities to another, then consider it a conflict. Now, what is the, what does it mean for representation of one or more clients to be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another? If you're in a situation where if you were able to use information that's confidential to another client to help this other client, or even more sort of blatantly obvious, if it would be crucial for client A to know the confidential thing for client B, that's materially limited, because you can't exercise your duties of loyalty and care to client A and client B at the same time, knowing full well that the confidential information of client B, which you have a duty not to disclose and not to make it disclosable, you can't really serve client A properly. Now, a former client, that's rather obvious. A third person, that's sort of, how is this? As is often said, that's just vague enough to work. Of a third person, the whole idea is that you don't want to be in conflict with any third party that you're aware of and deal with on a regular basis, because it would be really silly to say, well, you have a duty to every third person. Well, you don't. You have a duty to third persons with whom you have an actual duty. But here's the important part: or by a personal interest of the lawyer. So if your personal interests are involved, and that does happen sometimes, and it's more on the business law side than on the litigation side, but it does happen. If representing your client well means that you get screwed in some capacity, or that your interests are in danger in some way. Again, usually happens more on the business side than on the litigation side. But then you have to consider that it is really, how do I say this? It's not impossible to be selfless. However, the rules of professional responsibility assume that we're not selfless because we're humans. Despite what our clients do, or despite what the rest of the world says, that we lawyers aren't humans, we are humans. And the rules of professional responsibility assume that we are humans and that we don't want to work against our own interests. And so instead of allowing an attorney to make that noble sacrifice and harm themselves for the sake of their client, the rules are saying, no, you can't do that. And even if you try to do it, if you feel good about it, it's a problem, because, well, it's okay if you feel good about it, I guess. But, if you're making this noble sacrifice, you're still in violation of the rules of professional responsibility. So maybe don't make that noble sacrifice. Just politely step away. Now, that said, there are some exceptions to the conflict of interest rule. Let's go through them in detail. So, exception one, the lawyer reasonably believes that the lawyer will be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each affected client. Notice it says reasonably believe. So, we're down to this reasonable attorney standard, which is which can be rather dangerous. But there are some, places where you can do this. So, for example, if you are on the litigation side, if you're dealing with co-defendants or co-plaintiffs, Sure, you can reasonably believe that you're able to provide competent representation to each affected client. Sure, no problem. Now, on the business side, it's usually if you have multiple clients in a transaction and their interests are technically aligned insofar as they're on one side of the transaction, but they are separate parties, that's fine. You can have that conflict waived. So, or two, the representation is not prohibited by law. Great. Three, representation does not involve the assertion of a claim of one client against another client represented by the lawyer in the same litigation or other proceeding before a tribunal. Okay, this is where we're just discussing co-defendants or co-plaintiffs. So if you have multiple clients that they're both defendants in a particular lawsuit, and they're not asserting cross claims against each other, and that's by their own choice, sure, go for it. If, on the other hand, they are asserting cross claims against each other other than indemnification, because obviously indemnification is, that's rather typical and just says, hey, you're responsible for your liability. I'm responsible for my liability. That doesn't come to a conflict. But if there are serious cross claims between them, you really shouldn't be representing these co-defendants. And finally, with all of these things, each affected client gives informed consent, confirmed in writing. So, we were discussing earlier about how informed consent means you need to provide the client with all of the risks or substantially all of the risks associated with it. When you're dealing with the conflict waiver with respect to litigation, there are lots of forms out there that you can use. You can ask me for mine. I'm happy to give it to you. On the business side, I have a modified form that I put together for transactional conflict of interest. Again, feel free to reach out to me. I'm more than happy to give you that form. Okay, so let's go through some of the some hypotheticals and how we can apply these particular rules. Okay, so number one, on the business side, we're going to go back and forth between business and between transactional law and litigation, because I personally do both in my practice, and I know that a lot of solo practitioners do both. So it's important to show both. So, number one, representing a client's competition. If you're representing a client's competition with respect to a transaction involving your client, that's a huge conflict. If, however, you're representing a client's competition with respect to an unrelated transaction, that's okay. So let me give you an example. I have a colleague of mine, really, really great colleague, and all she does all day long is marketing law. And she's one of the best I've ever seen at it. And just inherent to what she does, she often has to represent clients who are in competition with each other. But what does she do? She just checks the regulations to make sure that their marketing and advertising is compliant. That's what she does. She doesn't litigate on their behalf. She's not, litigating against the competition. So there, if you were to say you can never represent a client's competition no matter what, she would be out of a job. Rather, she could only represent one client per industry, and that's just dumb. So here, take that example into consideration. You can represent a client's competition so long as two things. One, that you're not representing a client's competition directly against your client with respect to that particular representation, whether it be a litigation or a transaction. That's number one. And number two, that your representation of the client's competition does not rely upon confidential information of your client. So let me give you any, I'll give you an example. So if, say, this colleague of mine is representing multiple players in the same industry, say, I don't know, perfumists, right? Now, she theoretically could, as part of her service, blab one to the other as to what one is doing in terms of their marketing. But the thing is, that's not inherent to her representation. She doesn't have to provide that information, from clients about client A to client B in order to competently represent client B. And therefore, there's really no conflict. So long as she doesn't do that, because if she makes that disclosure, which she would never do, then it would break the rules of confidentiality. But in terms of representing a client's competition, you don't necessarily, you can represent multiple players in a similar industry, and keep their own secrets separate. But that's okay. You can compartmentalize. It's possible. All right, moving on. Representing co-parties in any litigation. We talked about this a little before, but it bears repeating. So if you are dealing with multiple parties on one side of litigation versus or the other, and they don't have serious cross claims against each other, obviously you have indemnification and contribution. But other than that, other than those sort of pro forma, each pays their own bill type of cross claims, if you don't have that, then you can represent co-parties in the litigation without a problem. Just make sure that they all sign the conflict waiver. Now, representing a former client's competition or adversary in litigation. And this is a really, really important one. So if you are representing a former client's competition or their adversary in a litigation, you have to see what's happening between the former client and the current client. If they're in litigation and you have to go after the former client, in most cases, you can't waive it. In some cases, you can. And those cases are usually when the former client is so big and so, what do you call it? If that client is so massive that it's really impossible not to represent them in the industry, or it's really impossible not to deal with them on the adversarial side. And the only example I can give you is the city of New York. Now, I have seen, and I don't represent the city of New York, although I did when I was at a big law firm before I started on my own. And I saw this happening all the time, where defense attorneys would have to assert serious claims against the city of New York, and they even both plaintiff side and defense side, and they would have to have the city do a waiver, at which, by the way, they have to by statute, because it is impossible to represent the city of New York in anything and not also go against the city of New York if you're, say, in the personal injury game, at least here in the city of New York, right? Like, it just is what it is. So long as you're not going against the city and representing the city in the same transaction or the same litigation, usually it's okay. That can be waived. Let's move on to the next conflict issue. There's negotiating both sides of a transaction. This is really, really wonky. I've seen it done before. I've seen it where the attorney tries to do the third party neutral thing in a transaction. It becomes really difficult. In my experience, I say don't do it. Usually I pick one side and say to the other side, okay, go ahead and get counsel. Here's a referral to competent counsel that I know and trust, who can handle what you were doing. And that way we can do this properly. Now, sometimes these conflicts are waivable. Sometimes they can't. You gotta know. And the big question of, okay, well, Todd, when can they be waived and when they can't? So the general rule is if it's inherent, if it's an inherent conflict, can't be waived. So
Esquire CLE's first verification code is TOP. T-O-P, all lowercase, TOP. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is TOP. T-O-P, all lowercase, TOP. Please take a moment and write this down.
You're not going to be able to waive, say, for example, the conflict between representing a plaintiff and the same and a defendant in the same litigation. That's not happening, right? That can't be waived. What is waived? But if it's something that's a little bit of a gray area, or that you see that the interests of multiple parties are alignable, not meaning that they're not necessarily always aligned all the time, but they're for the most part not against each other, well, then that could be waived. And finally, we'll talk about just for a moment, once again, the importance of informed consent to waive a conflict. Now, there are a couple of ways of knowing about it, and I actually suggest that you do both. One way is to just have a conversation with the client about what it means to waive a conflict before you have them sign the waiver. And the other thing that I've seen people do is put in their waiver language that says that they, you know, they've been provided informed consent, which, by the way, is not, unless you have lots of details in there as to what that means, and you know the client acknowledges this and the client acknowledges that, just saying the client is you know has been informed is not exactly going to work, because, and this is really important, the ethics rules are not here to protect us. They are here to protect the clients. Remember, we are a self-regulating industry in the legal practice, and the rules of professional responsibility always assume that the client is an idiot, right? The client is just so not reasonable that, you know, any little thing that's not, you know, fully spelled out in writing, assume that they don't understand it. And yes, it's a little insulting, and yes, it's a little problematic to think about humanity that way. But if you do think about humanity that way, and you, at least with respect to things like this, and you therefore act in such a way that you're, you know, double covering yourself by, you know, having the conversation with the, you know, with the client and also having them sign a consent waiver that spells out specific issues, not just says, I have, you know, I give my consent and I've been informed, then you're good. I mean, as much as it's annoying to, you know, think about the idea that, you know, the rules assume that every client's an idiot. If you just kind of take that in stride and try and sort of double cover, then you're never going to have a problem. Okay. Now, what if you do have a problem? Now, that's Rule 8.4. That's misconduct. I'm not going to use this as a way to, you know, scare or, you know, try to. You know, try to make things, you know, worse than they are. But it is really important that we do have the misconduct question, issue handled. Otherwise, you know, what are you doing? So it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to A, violate or attempt to violate the rules of professional professional conduct, or knowingly assist or induce another to do so, or through the acts of another. So this is the no patsy rule, right? Just because we're, you know, just because you're not the one who's violating the rule does not mean that you're not responsible for your agents in violating the rule. Important. B, commit a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. Now, it's arguable that any criminal act reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. But there are some criminal acts that are sort of inherent to that, right? Like perjury clearly reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness. Banking fraud would certainly go against fitness as a lawyer in other respects. But You got to be careful, and hopefully you never have to deal with this particular subsection. This particular subsection is dealt with for, like Michael Cohen type situations where he's, been convicted of violating the elections law, right? Does that reflect upon their fitness as a lawyer in other respects? Well, he hasn't been disbarred yet, so we'll see. Engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. That is rather straightforward. Engage in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. Some folks might argue that for example, criminal defense attorney, who doesn't, that some criminal defense attorneys are inherently engaging in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice, but I don't think that's the case. I think you need to actually find something. I think you need to actually find something that actually does that, like tampering with evidence or something like that, because everyone deserves representation. All right, state or imply an ability to influence improperly a government agency or official to achieve results by means that violate the rules of professional conduct or other law. So this here is a little wishy-washy. So if there is a difference between saying, oh, I know this judge very well, this judge and I have a good rapport, it's helpful that this judge is handling our case because we know what to expect, versus I know this judge very well, we play golf together, I'll put in a good word and he'll dismiss the case. That is clearly in violation. The first one, it's not stating or implying an ability to improperly influence the judge. It just says that, okay, I know this judge, I know their quirks, and I know sort of how to present evidence to them. That's one thing. It's another thing to say, okay, I know this judge very well, and I know exactly how to how to bribe them so that they can, give my client a favorable result. Like that's clearly different. Yeah. F, knowingly assist a judge or judicial officer in conduct that is in violation of applicable rules of judicial conduct or other law. That actually goes exactly to the example that I just described, whereby you are, you're helping a judge perform misconduct in the form of accepting a bribe. And then finally, G, engage in conduct that a lawyer knows or reasonably should know is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status, and conduct related to the practice of law. So this is really important because it's the sort of obvious don't discriminate rule. Now, in terms of something like socioeconomic status, if your client cannot afford your fees and you say, I'm sorry, you can't afford my fees, I'm not representing you, that does not mean that you have discriminated based on socioeconomic status. Now, if you are the type of attorney who takes stuff on contingency, and where your ability to get your fees is based solely on whether you get a favorable settlement or a judgment, and you're not taking on a client because they are, in Section 8 housing or something, that would be discrimination based on socioeconomic status. And yes, I'm focusing on that specifically because all the other ones are super obvious, right? Don't discriminate based on race, sex, religion, national origin, etc. However, for socioeconomic status, that I need to be a little clear. We need to be more clear about. Like, it is one thing to say I'm not going to take you on because you're poor, for its own sake. As another thing to say, I'm not taking you on because you specifically cannot afford my fees, and therefore it does not make sense for me economically. Very different. That goes to the merits of what you're doing in your business, as opposed to taking on someone or not taking them on if it based on socioeconomic status, if that doesn't affect your business. Now, this paragraph does not limit the ability of a lawyer to accept, decline, or withdraw from representation in accordance with Rule 1.16. We'll go through that in detail. This paragraph does not preclude legitimate advice or advocacy consistent with these rules, which, of course, is fair enough. Now, we will go through the New York rule, which is a little different. So what I was giving you before was the model rule. Let's go through the New York rule together, just because it's helpful to see how subtle differences in the rules and how they are structured can affect the way things are done. So New York Rule 8.4 says, a lawyer or law firm shall not, A, violate or attempt to violate the rules of professional misconduct, knowingly assist or induce another to do so through the acts of another. Okay, check that off. We have that in the model rules. B, engage in illegal conduct that reflects or adversely reflects on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in general, not in other respects. Interesting little change there. C, inducting conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. That's check it off the list. That's the same. D, engage in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. Check off the list. E, state or imply an ability, one, to influence improperly or upon irrelevant grounds any tribunal, legislative body, or public official. That's one thing. Two, to achieve results using means that violate these rules or other law. Now, I'm going back to Model Rule 8.4 here. That is effectively the same. So we move on. F, knowingly says a judge, judicial officer, and conduct as a violation of applicable rules, the same. G, here's where things are a little different. Unlawfully discriminate in the practice of law, including in hiring, promoting, or otherwise determining conditions of employment. All right, so now we're talking about mostly employment-related discrimination as opposed to harassment or discrimination. That's more generalized. On the basis of age, race, creed, color, national origin, sex, disability, don't have disability up there in the model rule. Oh, no, yes, we do, sorry. Marital status or sexual orientation. Note gender identity is not in there. All right, we go back up. Hey, look, nope, gender identity is not there in the New York rule. And marital status is. So why does this matter? This matters because if you are in New York and you are, I guess you could theoretically speaking, discriminate in hiring against a transgender person, although I don't know why you would do that. If you were to do that, if with respect to regular employment law, you'd be liable, but with respect to the rules of professional responsibility, technically you wouldn't be. It's silly. It's annoying, but these are the kinds of things you need to be aware of. Now, where there is a tribunal with jurisdiction to hear a complaint, if timely brought, other than the Departmental Disciplinary Committee, a complaint based on the unlawful discrimination shall be brought before such tribunal in the first instance, and the rest of this portion is about procedure. And finally, H, engage in other conduct that adversely reflects on the lawyer's fitness as a lawyer, and that is just vague enough to work. Now, let's move on to a real-life case study. This is something that has been something that I've dealt with in my own practice, and something that I think is sort of a really great way of showing how you can violate multiple rules in one fact pattern, so to speak. So let's go into that. So an attorney in state of Soda, it's called Mr. S, represents both sides in the purchase of privately held stock in a publicly traded company. All right, so now we have representing both sides of a transaction, which could be okay. And consideration for the purchase of stock, the down payment, and a promissory note. Mr. S does not obtain written conflict waiver from either client. Okay, now we have a problem. We have a potential conflict of interest here by virtue of the fact that you're dealing with multiple sides on a transaction whose interests are adverse to one another, or could be adverse to one another, and you don't have a written conflict waiver. 1 year later, purchaser misses their payments, and Mr. S brings an action against the purchaser on behalf of the seller. The purchaser brings a counterclaim, represented by separate counsel, against the seller and against Mr. S personally for malpractice. So what do we have here? We have purchaser misses the payment, and Mr. S is representing the purchaser against the seller. Representing the seller against the purchaser in the litigation. That is a clear conflict of interest. For one, technically speaking, he's not representing both sides in the litigation. However, this person is so close to the initial transaction and represented both sides of the transaction, therefore is violating their duties to the a former client in this situation by representing the other side in litigation against them specifically. Now, as litigation begins, Mr. S advises the seller to rename himself CEO of the company and begin operating again, since he knows the purchaser, who is actually the rightful CEO, has no interest in running the company. So this is the attorney telling his client to masquerade as the CEO of this company, even though he knows full well that this person has no business calling himself the CEO of the company. So that goes to the engaging in conduct that is considered deceit. Now, to fund the litigation between purchaser and seller, seller seeks a loan from a third party, let's call him Mr. G, for operations, quote unquote. Mr. S represents both sides in the loan agreement. The loan agreement stipulates as collateral shares in the companies that Mr. S knows the seller doesn't currently own and are the subject of that litigation. Mr. S doesn't inform Mr. G of that fact and places a warranty that the shares belong to the seller in the loan agreement. Mr. S is the notary on the loan agreement for both sides' signatures. So this we have, a real cluster F here. So Mr. S is representing both sides in a loan agreement. That inherently is not necessarily a conflict. It's never represented Mr. G before. And the loan agreement stipulates something that Mr. S knows to be untrue, and tells his other client, Mr. G, that it is true, even though he knows it's not true, inducing him to sign it and to give his client a loan so that client can continue paying his legal fees. That is an issue for multiple reasons. So now let's continue the saga here. During settlement negotiations, Mr. S represents the seller in the purchase of the same shares. It's called the new purchase by Mr. G, who believed until now that the shares were in the seller's possession, even though they were not. He was told by Mr. S, who was his attorney in that loan agreement, in the loan negotiation, that he was that he owned the shares. During the negotiation of the new purchase, Mr. S reveals the truth to Mr. G's attorney, who in this case is me, that the original purchaser owns the shares, and that the shares are are currently under litigation. So, when asked about the loan agreement, Mr. S stated to Mr. G's attorney that he drafted it, but wasn't aware as to whether it was signed or not. Well, he's the notary on that loan agreement. It's his stamp and his jurat on the loan agreement. So he knows full well that this loan agreement was signed and sealed. So to what extent did Mr. S violate the model rules of professional conduct? Let's go through it together. So number one, confidentiality. He is in fact using confidentiality as a sword by effectively lying about private information to between clients. There's also a conflict of interest in the initial transaction potentially because he did not get an informed consent waiver. in the litigation itself, because he's representing one client against another client with respect to the same transaction or occurrence. Three, in the loan agreement, by virtue of the fact that he misrepresented the facts to a client that was he was representing in the loan agreement for both his own benefit and also for the benefit of his other client. And finally, in negotiating the final sale, there's this inherent issue here because he is conflicted in two ways. Number one, by virtue of what he did previously. Number two, by virtue of the fact that he is currently in this scenario being sued by a former client for malpractice, and that wasn't being disclosed properly. And finally, just general misconduct. Half of the stuff this person is doing is inherently deceitful, especially when you're lying about a knowledge of a contract that you notarize yourself, bit of an issue. And my question is, the question you might have asked yourself is, well, what do you do in this situation? What are your duties? If you see this happening, well, if you see this happening, you have a choice. You can either report it or not. And if it would be considered, if it would be considered harmful to your client to report that misconduct, that's one thing. But it wasn't, so I report them. That's really, if it's the kind of thing where you see something that's a technical, it's technically incorrect, that's one thing. Where it's blatantly, blatant disregard for the rules and blatantly deceitful, that's another. And that's the, for me, that's the threshold. If I think that it's problematic for an attorney to continue, conducting themselves in this particular way, that's like, it has a material adverse effect on the profession, right? And that's a really high standard to meet. And those happen occasionally, and that's what I report. So, let's move on to solicitation. This goes now that we're done with the scaring you misconduct stuff. Let's go to some stuff that actually affects your business on a daily basis. So New York and Model Rule 7.3, I'm doing solicitation. This has to do with how you get your business as a solo practitioner. Very important. So a lawyer shall not buy in person, live telephone, or real time electronic contact. In other words, email. Contact solicit professional employment when a significant motive for the lawyer is doing so is the lawyer's pecuniary gain. So why is this in there? Is this considered, isn't it always inherent that the lawyer is doing so for their pecuniary gain? Not if they're doing it pro bono. Therein lies the rub. If you are soliciting somebody for that you're willing to do pro bono, or you're part of a legal aid program, this doesn't really apply because your legal fees are, you're not being paid. So you cannot have a significant motive being your pecuniary gain. Now, theoretically speaking, if you're doing pro bono hours, you can, that can go towards your CLE in some states, but that's not considered, your pecuniary gain. That's just, cost avoidance. So unless the person contacted, right? So we have lawyer shall not solicit somebody that's not for a pro bono matter unless the person contacts is a lawyer, him or herself, or has a family, close personal, or other prior professional relationship with the lawyer. So what does this mean? This means that you can solicit other attorneys, and you can solicit family. You could solicit your close personal friends or folks. Or former clients. So when I reach out to my corporate clients as an example, say, hey, it's been a little while since we've chatted. Is there anything that you'd like that you'd like my assistance with? That's okay. I have a prior professional relationship with that client. If on the other hand, I'm just reaching out to people, cold calling them and saying, hey, I'm an attorney. I'd like you to hire me. That is a violation of the rule against solicitation. Now, keep in mind that solicitation is different from advertising and marketing. And it's different insofar as it's a one-on-one type of interaction. So if you're going back to New York and model rule of language, it says by in-person, live telephone, or real-time electronic contact. It's one-on-one. It's not like you're blasting something out to a huge list. And then the whole idea is you're not pressuring them by being there, you know, in person, or being, you know, direct and saying, hey, you know, I want you to hire me. That's a very different kind of thing. Now, let's talk about networking within the rules. This is really important for solo practitioners because this is our bread and butter. If you are networking with people and you want them to hire you, obviously, if you're networking with certain folks that you want to hire, that's totally fine. However, you cannot do it as that initial contact. You can't say, hey, hire me. And it's a little annoying to see other folks networking who are allowed to do that, may ask for the sale immediately upon meeting somebody. But in your capacity as a networker, you actually have a really easy way around this. You can say, okay, here's my card, let me take yours. Can we set up a time to chat and, you know, see how we can help each other? Then and only then can you have a separate conversation. And if it comes up that they that there's something that they want your help with, cool, no problem. You didn't technically solicit them because you were, you know, something popped up during a typical networking conversation. Now, the live seminar problem. If you are doing a live seminar with a bunch of audience members who are non-attorneys, because remember, this does not apply to non-attorneys. It doesn't apply if you're soliciting an attorney, because that would be really weird, right? Like not being allowed to call a law firm and say, hey, do you have, you know, can I get some work from you? And that would be kind of weird, especially as a solo practitioner. Dealing with other firms is in getting work from them is a really big part of how a lot of us, you know, do what we do. But if you're doing a live seminar to a bunch of non-attorneys, what generally happens is they'll come up, you know, they'll come up to you and it might be considered solicitation if you ask for the sale right then and there. But what you can do is ask for the follow-up conversation as a separate point of contact. And then you are, technically speaking, not soliciting. Very helpful. So, let's talk about marketing and advertising, which I was just saying before is not the same as solicitation. Now, the model rule 7.1, 7.2, and 7.4 exist here, and they're all really important. So let's just go through them. They're actually very simple. Rule 7.1, do not have misleading conduct in your marketing and advertising. So don't say, I will get $1 million for you specifically. That's obviously misleading. Rule 7.2, it allows for media advertisements and payment for advertising services. This goes back to a long time ago, about, 30 years ago, when attorneys were not allowed to be on TV or to do something like that. And the idea was that it was against the rules of professional conduct. Now, with Rule 7.2, you're allowed to pay a media company to do advertising for you. Rule 7.4, representations of practice areas. You're allowed to say what your practice areas are. Do not say that you specialize in something unless a court of competent jurisdiction has given you the sort of mantle of being a specialist in a thing. And that's really hard for solo practitioners who are not litigators or mediators, because those are the only practice areas that the court will give to you. So instead of saying specializing in, you can say I practice in. That's fine. And finally, two New York ethics domains of note, I would say, social media posts and online reviews. Now, most other states have gone through with the exact same thing, which is to say that in your social media posts, you have to make the attorney advertising disclosure. And that's the same with your blog posts and what have you. Everything is attorney advertising, apparently. And with respect to online reviews, if you are using online reviews for marketing purposes, and why not? It's a really great way to show prospective clients how much your clients love you. You just have to make sure that those online reviews are not based on a currently pending matter, that it's based on a matter that has already passed. So that said, we have this one example of where you really should be checking your state. So here in New York, the model rule 7.1 is way more inclusive than the model rule 7.1 with respect to advertising. So in most other states, you do not have to use the Sarbanes-Oxley disclaimer of prior results do not guarantee similar outcome. In New York, you do. In New York, you have to say attorney advertising in
Esquire CLE's second verification code is LOG, L-O-G, all lowercase, LOG. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is LOG, L-O-G, all lowercase, LOG. Please take a moment and write this down.
Large, prominent letters in any form of attorney advertising, and yes, it includes your blog posts, it includes your social media, it includes your website, everything. There's no use of trade names that imply results, so you can't say, I'll get you $1,000,000.com. No use of actors in commercials. You're at least in New York, if you are an attorney, you cannot have an actor who, is presumably more beautiful or handsome than you come and say, hi, I'm attorney Todd Culkin, blah, 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 and it's not attorney Todd Culkin. You can't do that. And finally, the rules apply to online advertising as well. Now, let's go through the no contact rule. So in representing a client, a lawyer shall not communicate about the subject of the representation, that's the rub, with a person the lawyer knows to be represented by another lawyer in the matter, unless the lawyer has the consent of the other lawyer or is authorized to do so by law or a court order. In New York, there's the additional rule. Notwithstanding the prohibitions of paragraph A, and unless otherwise provided by law, a lawyer may cause a client to communicate with a represented person unless the represented person is not legally competent, and may counsel the client with respect to those communications, provided the lawyer gives reasonable advance notice to represented person's counsel that such communications will be taking place. I use this rule all the time. And if you're a New York attorney and you're not using this rule, I highly suggest that you take a look at it. So especially if you are a business, if you handle things on the business side, this works with the litigators too. The clients can talk to each other and usually work things out with each other way better than attorneys can. And so as an attorney, you can counsel and coach your client as to how to how to speak with the other side, so long as you let the other attorney know that they're going to be talking. Now, if these folks are business associates, they're probably always going to be talking. So the first thing that I do in those situations where I see that the other side is represented by counsel, I have a conversation with counsel and I follow up with an email stating that these folks are, business associates. They are going to talk all the time. It is what it is. I can't give you advance notice that unless I know when that is going to happen. Now, that does happen sometimes and I do give the advance notice, but again, if you're a New York attorney and you are in either the litigation side or the transactional side, and you're not, say, a mediator, this is really a helpful rule for you. Now, referral fees, specifically to non-lawyers, New York Rule 7.2, there's no model rule equivalent. A lawyer shall not compensate or give anything of value to a person or organization to recommend or obtain employment by a client or as a reward for having made a recommendation resulting in employment by a client, except that a lawyer or law firm may refer clients to a non-legal professional or a non-legal professional service firm pursuant to a contractual relationship to provide legal and other professional services on a systematic continuing basis, provided, however, that such referral shall not otherwise include any monetary or other tangible consideration or reward as such, or the sharing of legal fees. And finally, sharing of legal fees between attorneys is permissible. Make sure it is a true, quote-unquote, co-counsel type of relationship. Now, in most states, co-counsel is sort of willy-nilly. You'll give referral fees to each other. In New York, if you do give a referral fee to another attorney and you do it as you're co-representing the client, and you're making sure that the amount that you're receiving, the percentage of the fee is based on what you are, what you're actually doing, the amount of involvement that you actually have in the case. Prepaid services and prepaid legal and referral services, Rule 7.2b2, it allows attorneys to be recommended, employed or paid by, or may cooperate with one of the following offices or organizations, promote the use of lawyer services, yada, yada, yada. There are three kinds: legal aid office, military legal assistance office, or a lawyer referral service. A lawyer referral service needs to be, and this is really important, registered with the state as a lawyer referral service. But that is a little different from membership programs. So, legal service organizations with a membership system like Legal Shield, Rocket Lawyer, and even LegalZoom is doing this too, are a great tool for obtaining clients. Rule 7.2 has six conditions for a lawyer to participate in such a thing. And by the way, if you're a solo like me, I highly suggest you do so because it's a great way to get clients. The lawyer shall have initiated or promoted such organization for the primary purpose of providing a financial benefit. Sure, that's pretty easy to fulfill. Such organization does not operate for the purpose of procuring legal work or financial benefit for any lawyer as a private practitioner outside the legal services program. So, in other words, you need to be a member attorney in the network to be, you know, to be recommended. The member or beneficiary to whom legal services is furnished and not such organization is recognized as the client. So, in other words, the client is the person who's being referred, not the referral service itself. The legal service plan of such organization provides appropriate relief for any member or beneficiary who acts improperly or inadequate representation that is sort of inherent. A lawyer does not know or have cause to know that such organization is in violation of applicable laws, rules of court, or other legal requirements that governs legal service operations. Again, that's rather obvious as well. And such organization is filed with the appropriate disciplinary authority an annual report. Just check in about your particular state. Now, referral fees in the real world. This is really important, especially for those, solos like me who are constantly, out there networking. So other industries and professions give referral incentives. This is inherent to every other industry except ours, and maybe is a little frustrating, but it is what it is. Honestly, in all fairness, you can't really, doctors can't really do it either. But anyway, sometimes they expect it, which is certainly understandable if you're networking with people. And they're trying to, sending clients your way. They, sometimes if they're not attorneys themselves, they're going to expect some kind of something for it. So what do you do? And there are four steps to it that I like. So number one, explain the rules that applies to lawyers. I say, look, I'm not allowed to do this. Explain that no amount of business is worth my license. I don't care if you're sending, millions of dollars my way. I'm not going to lose my license for this. You can call an exchange of goodwill. Say, look, I'm not going to take a referral fee from you. You're not going to take a referral fee from me. We'll just refer each other to situations where it's appropriate. And then don't take referral fees on the other side, although technically speaking, you could. You could take referral fees on the other side if you are recommending a third party who is not an attorney to another third party who's not an attorney and who's not your client to do a transaction together. You could get a referral fee for that. You should not be getting referral fees for sending your clients to folks because that's a conflict of interest. Non-legal services. So this is extremely helpful for folks like me who, have multiple business hats. So an attorney may offer non-legal type services, for example, consulting, without those activities being subject to the rules of professional responsibility if and only if, IFF, the client does not reasonably believe that they are doing that they are being represented by an attorney. Now that is really, that's the kind of thing where you can get yourself in trouble. So I've come up with some techniques that I use in my own businesses to make sure that there is separation, and I suggest that you do the same. One, open a separate entity for your non-legal type service business. So I have two entities. I have Lost the Tough Culkin and Thales Consulting. They do not mix. They have separate bank accounts. They have separate EINs. They are all entirely separated out. Two, sign non-disclosure agreements between your non-legal service client and your non-legal service company. That way, there is a duty of confidentiality that you can rely upon that is not attorney-client privilege in that instance. And that's assuming that your non-legal services business is even handling confidential information, which in the case of business consulting is the case, but might not be for what you're doing. Promptly disclaim any attorney-client relationship and any and all contracts between your non-legal service business and their clients. I put it in really big letters. I do multiple disclaimers, and so you know the attorney, the client acknowledges and agrees that you know there is no attorney-client relationship between you know them and Todd Culkin, based solely on the fact that they're a Thales consulting client. Oh, and by the way, I also have the and maybe this is a little bit of overkill, but I do like to double cover. I have the client initial that particular section, just so it's really impossible for them not to have read it. Now, don't the last one, and this is you don't have to do this, just something that I do. Don't mix your client base. Unless you reasonably believe that your independent judgment as an attorney representing that client would be completely unaffected by your non-legal service relationship. That is unfortunately entirely in the eye of the beholder. Now, moving on to dealing with an unrepresented party. Model Rule 4.3. A lawyer shall not state or imply that the lawyer is disinterested when dealing with an unrepresented party. You say, I'm representing this person when I'm talking to you. When the lawyer knows or reasonably should know that the represented unrepresented person misunderstands the lawyer's role in the matter, lawyers shall make reasonable efforts to correct the misunderstanding. So if you're talking with somebody who's unrepresented, and they say, well, you're neutral here, so blah, blah, you say, no, I represent this person. I'm not neutral. And finally, lawyers shall not give legal advice to an unrepresented person other than the advice of secure counsel. If the lawyer knows or reasonably should know that the interests of such person are or have the reasonable possibility of being in conflict of interest with the client. Let's go through unrepresented versus represented. Here's a scenario. Company X is founded by two partners, A and B. You're retained to represent A in negotiations with B. How do you handle the negotiations if B is represented by counsel? Well, you have your you have no contact rule in play. If B isn't represented by counsel, then you use the dealing with unrepresented party rule 4.3, related matters. And finally, If B lawyers up during the process, you switch up so that you are in the you were doing the unrepresented thing and now you're switching up to dealing with a represented party. Now let's go through quickly some trust account considerations. This is Rule 1.15. Everyone knows not to commingle funds, but there are some pitfalls you need to avoid which aren't obvious, especially if you're a solo practitioner like me. We are responsible for our own IOLA or IALTA account. Just because we're not, we don't have a big fancy firm behind us, does not absolve us of that responsibility. So we have to be really clear. So number one, never take cash out of your escrow account, even to give it to a client. Always use a check or a wire transfer. Now here in New York, not every state does this, but in New York you can also give your client a prepaid debit card or traveler's check, so long as the client gives informed consent. All right, there's a couple of ethics opinions that actually, there was somewhat recent that came out, which states that in the event that your client asks you for a prepaid debit card for their funds, you can do it so long as you let them know that, that how different it is from a check or wire transfer. And by the way, when would this be? When would this matter? If you're dealing with the client that doesn't have a bank account, this goes to the socioeconomic issue. These are folks who go to check cashing places. Now, one thing that you need to do, keep a ledger that shows the following: date of transaction, name of client, transactional funds, purpose of the transaction, source of funds, and any other necessary information. Keep your records clean. And finally, when using an IOLA or IOLTA account, make sure that your escrow agreements have the client's waive interest that because that interest belongs to the local pro bono fund. This is really important. If you are dealing with a multi-million dollar transaction or a multi-million dollar settlement on the litigation side, a significant amount of interest is accrued. So if you have an escrow agreement, and you should have an escrow agreement, or it should be part of your engagement agreement if you're on the litigation side, to make it very clear that any interest that is accrued on that account is waived by the client, because the account does not actually belong to you. It belongs to the local pro bono fund, and they get all the interest. Rule 1.16, firing a client, perhaps my favorite. ABA Model Rule 1.16, the lawyer shall not represent a client or where representation has commenced, shall withdraw from representing the client if, here are all your reasons where you're allowed to do it. One, the representation will result in a violation of the rules of professional conduct. Two, the lawyer's physical or mental condition materially impairs the lawyer's ability to represent the client. Three, the lawyer is discharged. So that's all rather obvious. Now, B, this is where it gets interesting. A lawyer may withdraw from representing a client if, one, withdrawal can be accomplished without material adverse effect on the client. Two, the client persists in the course of action involving lawyer services that the lawyer reasonably believes is criminal or fraudulent. By the way, I've had to do this in the past. It's not fun. Three, the client has used the lawyer's services to perpetuate a crime or fraud. Four, the client insists upon taking action that the lawyer considers repugnant or with which the lawyer has a fundamental disagreement. Five, the client fails substantially to fulfill an obligation to the lawyer regarding the lawyer's services, and then given a reasonable warning, the lawyer will withdraw unless the obligation is fulfilled. Usually that involves the payment of fees. Six, the representation will result in an unreasonable financial burden on the lawyer or has been rendered unreasonably difficult by the client. Or seven, other good cause for withdrawal exists. So this allows you to fire a client in these very specific scenarios. Very helpful. Now, when you're doing this, right, if you're going to fire a client, a couple things you need to do. A lawyer must comply with the applicable law requiring notice to or permission of a tribunal when terminating representation. So for those who are litigators out there, you have to, you know, make your motion to withdraw. Now, if you're ordered to do so by a tribunal, a lawyer shall continue representation, notwithstanding the good cause for terminating representation, and I would just say good luck. D, upon termination representation, a lawyer shall take steps to the extent reasonably practicable to protect the client's interests, including giving reasonable notice to the client, allowing time for employment of the counsel, surrendering papers and property to which the client is entitled, and refunding any advance payment or fee or expense that has not been earned or incurred. The lawyer may retain papers related to the client to the extent permitted by other law. That is rather straightforward. Now, Rule 2.4, attorney as third party neutral. So this is a situation that I come across occasionally, effectively when you're asking to mediate. So if you are serving as third party neutral and you're assisting two or more persons who are not clients separately, it does happen sometimes. You might be a mediator or an arbitrator or something along those lines. If you're serving as third party neutral, you have to inform everybody that the lawyer is not representing them unless they have their own counsel. When a lawyer knows or reasonably should know that a party does not understand the lawyer's role in the matter, they'll explain the difference between the lawyer's role as third party neutral and one who represents a client. When I do third party neutral, and it is only occasionally, I always tell each side, you are encouraged to be represented by counsel. I do not represent either of you. I am entirely neutral here. Please do not treat me like I am your attorney. And of course, I follow that up in writing in plain English. And finally, duties to prospective clients, Rule 1.18. Even when no client-lawyer relationship ensues, a lawyer who has learned information from a prospective client shall not use or reveal that information, except as 1.9 will permit, with respect to such information of a former client. So this is if someone comes to you and you do an initial consult and you learn confidential things, you can't use those confidential things to harm that person. So that's rather straightforward. A lawyer subject to paragraph B shall not represent a client with interests materially adverse to those in prospective client in the same or substantially related matter if the lawyer received information from the prospective client that could be significantly harmful to that person in that matter. The lawyer is disqualified from representation. No lawyer in a firm with which that lawyer is associated may knowingly undertake or continue representation in such a matter, except as provided in paragraph D. That doesn't really apply to solo practitioners, but that's okay. So this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about, say a would-be divorcee going around to every matrimonial attorney in town, doing initial consults to make sure that the other side, their would-be ex-wife or husband couldn't get representation. You see here in the rule where if the lawyer received information from the perspective that could be significantly harmful to the person in the matter, right? So if you're getting information in the initial consult, say if you're a divorce attorney, that would be significantly harmful to the to that person that wouldn't be otherwise discoverable easily, something that's purely confidential, then you have a problem. But keep in mind with the prospective clients that if you want to avoid this issue, then when you're doing the initial consult, you can make it clear and say, look, I'm not representing you yet. I just need the basic facts to see whether I can represent you. And we can't go into more detail until such time as I've been fully engaged. That protects you. If you're able to do that, you're not going to have an issue. So with respect to questions, comments, concerns, please feel free to email me, todd@kulkinlaw.com. That's Todd with two D's at kulkinlaw.com. Or you can give me a call, 212-485-9884. It's 212-485-9884. I hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as I've enjoyed giving this course. I'd love to hear from you. I really love hearing from folks who take my CLEs, whether it be to ask me a question or, correct me on something. Yes, I do actually like that. Or just to shoot the breeze. I really do appreciate it. So that said, I'm Todd Kulkin. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.